Last summer, both the city of Asheville and Buncombe County passed resolutions intended to begin making amends for generations of discrimination. The resolution included a goal of increasing Black home ownership. 90% of homeowners in Buncombe County are white, compared to 3.9% of homeowners who are African Americans. Evanston, Illinois, another U.S. city seeking to make reparations to minorities, is implementing a reparations program involving a housing grant program providing funding to those who can demonstrate that they are descendants of those impacted by redlining and other discriminatory housing policies in their city. What sort of reparations funding would you most like to see implemented in Asheville and Buncombe County? And would it apply only to descendants of Asheville residents during the areas of redlining, urban renewal, and Jim Crow, as does the Evanston program? Or would your ideal program extend to all Black residents of the city and county?
I'm really happy to have the opportunity to talk about the subject of reparations. It's incredibly gratifying that our city has finally, at least officially, acknowledged the deep and prolonged harm done to our Black neighbors and their families over a very long period of time. And I'm pleased that there has been a commitment to redress those harms. I think it's absolutely vitally important to the well-being of our city as a whole. I want to say, however, at the outset, that it is not my place to dictate to the Black community or to our city how reparations should happen, how they should be administered, how they should be allocated. We have in place currently a 25-member Reparations Commission, appointed both by the county and by the city, and they are doing the really hard work of trying to understand, document, and redress the harms that have been done historically and into the present day. I have confidence in them because I've been attending Reparations Commission's meetings whenever possible, and I have observed the wisdom and the diligence that they are bringing to this activity. It is really complicated. If there were easy answers to this, we'd already have them. But there are not. These are complex, multi-generational, historical circumstances. And trying to figure out what is the best approach and who should benefit in what way is not a simple matter. It is clear from my observations that, as should be expected, the folks who are participating on this committee have different perspectives about these issues. And they will have to do the hard work of coming to an agreement about how they think these matters should be properly addressed. But I have, as I say, tremendous confidence in them. I think this is a wonderful group of individuals who are coming together to do something truly historic. It's a painful history, but it can be a positive future for our city. I'll also follow with interest the work of another community-based project, the Reparations Stakeholder Authority of Asheville, which is being initially funded by SEDEC and is looking to become a 501c3. And these two enterprises don't need to be seen as being in conflict anyway. They can support and resonate with one another. But the bottom line on and the community-based one won't have as many kind of legal restrictions about what kind of money they can raise and how they can expend it. So they may be able to do things that the Reparations Committee cannot recommend directly themselves. Long story short, I am looking forward with great interest to the short-term, medium-term, and long-term recommendations of the Reparations Commission. And I see my role as a council member to ensure that that commission has the resources it needs, the time and resources that they need in order to do this very difficult but extremely important work. So if they need additional data, or if they need more funding to do their work, or if they need more time to do their work, whatever they need that the city can provide to support them in this vital activity, I'm in favor of doing that. And when their recommendations come down, I look forward to the opportunity to ensuring that the city makes those recommendations come to life. Oh, may I offer just one other quick note?
Sure.
You note that at the beginning about the goal of Black home ownership, it's worth noting that in the latest census, Asheville has a African-American population of just over 11%, which is down meaningfully from the last time the census was done in 2010. And so that just puts in starker contrast those percentages of 90% of homeowners being white and only 3.9% of homeowners being Black, because this shows the disproportionate nature of it. We have 11% of the population is Black, but only 3.9% of them are homeowners.
Asheville's January 2022 point in time count revealed the city's unsheltered population has doubled since the 2021 count. Between 2020 and 2022, shelter bed inventory declined from 285 to 144. Do you support the creation of more shelter spaces inside the city? And how would you respond to those homeowners, businesses, and neighborhood associations that do not want such shelter communities near their own?
Yes, I support the creation of more shelter spaces inside the city. Let me just get into the numbers a little bit here, if I may. It's important to note that in the point in time count, we had 637 persons identified as homeless, of which just over 400 were sheltered and 232 were unsheltered. And that was up 21% from the previous year. There's no question that the pandemic played a huge role in the increase in folks who are unsheltered. And one of the reasons that there was a decline in shelter bed, specifically shelter bed inventory, was because of COVID protocols that sought to reduce proximity of people in shelters. And that meant fewer beds because they were spaced further apart, for example. Part of what this outlines is the need for more non-congregate shelter. Altogether, there were 634 beds available at the time of the point in time count, and 560 of them went from 634 to 560, not just shelter beds, but of all different kinds: shelter beds, non-congregate beds, code purple, and transitional beds. And when you add all of those together, there were 155 open beds. Why that was not better coordinated to get people into those beds, I don't understand. But there are some other reasons why those beds went unused. And the point in time survey gave us insight into that. They asked the folks that they were surveying this question: why did you not take advantage of shelter that was offered to you or that was available? And the answers were, number one answer was the rules were too restrictive. And the second most common thing was some combination of it's too crowded and the people there are too scary. And the third most common response was they won't let me stay with my people, my partner, my friends, and I can't bring my pets. So people would rather be out in the cold and the horrible weather than be parted from their sources of love and community. And that makes complete sense to me. If you have to go into a shelter and you're separated from your partner, or one of these shelters that doesn't allow you or doesn't recognize your same-sex partner, for example, those would be reasons that would keep people from taking advantage of resources that are technically available to them. So that tells me that we are not providing shelter that meets the human needs of the folks. It's not just enough to say, here's a warm, dry place with a roof over your head. It has to be a place that supports people's basic human needs to be with the ones that they care about and that they know and feel safe and not like sardines in a can. This is perfectly understandable to me. Restrictive rules, it didn't go into a whole lot of detail about what that was about, but that's something that also should probably be investigated with more detail. But the bottom line here is, yes, the city needs more available shelters, but only if they're of the kind that people will seek out and find livable for them. But, you know, this doesn't have to be some kind of fancy high-end housing, but it does have to be something that supports their need to feel in community with people that they love, that will allow them to have their pets, so that they are not stripped of the things that bring them the most comfort just to have a roof over their head. It's important to know that I really feel that the issue of homelessness is not something that the city of Asheville can solve on its own. We are, and nor is it a problem that affects Asheville alone, as we know. This is a national level crisis brought about by a large combination of factors, and it will require, in order to resolve it in any meaningful way, it's going to require a response on the state level and on the national level. And by that, I mean effective social security nets that keep people from falling out of our most basic economic necessities. I think we need a universal healthcare system so that people are not made homeless or bankrupt by medical bills, by the need for substance abuse treatment, mental and physical health care. We're an embarrassment amongst developed nations in not providing this fundamental human right to our citizenry. It's shameful. Until we have that in place, there are going to be people who become unhoused because either their mental health or substance abuse issues are not being addressed, or they are in such medical debt that they can't afford to pay rent or mortgage. And that is just unbelievably inhumane. The other part of the equation would be, some kind of guaranteed right to housing. I'd like to see that happen at the national level. An alternative would be a universal basic income, so that no matter what person's life circumstances was, there would be a level of financial stability that would be there for them at all times. Again, these are things that Asheville cannot do on its as a city. We don't have the wherewithal for that. But as a nation, we are not going to be able to address these issues without some kind of solution along those lines. What Asheville can do, and it must do, is mitigate the harm. And that means keeping people from dying. I mean, having them live long enough to get the help that they need. And what I say to my neighbors who are concerned about the impact of homelessness in their neighborhoods is that that impact will be greatly reduced if people have safe, comfortable, and home-like shelter with the people that they care about, with their own community. That's going to greatly reduce the impact, the negative impacts that people perceive of having homeless folks in their neighborhood. If you are not providing people with the stability of a room of their own, essentially. The troubles that they experience are only going to continue to be exacerbated. I think we have to get very creative about how we do this. And I think one of the most important elements of it, whether it's a congregate shelter, whether it's supportive housing, whether it's a low barrier shelter, wherever we provide those services to folks, we also need to have a program of what I would call community integration, where there are opportunities for those folks who are in need of shelter and the residents of that neighborhood to meet in a safe, enjoyable, productive way, to break bread together, to get to know each other as individuals, as human beings with similar aspirations, similar concerns, and similar needs, so that the barriers of fear and distrust and ignorance about the full humanity of both parties can be broken down. Once you get to know someone as a human being, it's a lot harder to dismiss them as someone who is other and who needs to be handled in some way. So I would look to some of our faith-based communities to help facilitate that kind of community get-togethers. I think, organizations like Beloved have been doing this consistently, and we could look to them for models of how to create kind of, or Haywood Street congregations, another great example of that, where they create spaces where people can simply get to know one another in a way that is not threatening, is not judgmental, but allows for a dialogue that isn't easy to come by otherwise.
Some residents have been supportive of the choices of the city and county to encourage employers such as Pratt and Whitney to come to Asheville and Buncombe County. Detractors argue that the necessary tax incentives are too large, and that such industries are bolstering a military-industrial complex that causes deaths half a world away, while supporters say that the promised average wages at the new plant will exceed the county's average weekly wage of $916, and that such plants provide good jobs for locals. What would be your opinion on recruiting plants for the city and the county, which bring high-paying jobs but are not involved in military work?
As you know, Pratt & Whitney is a done deal. That's going to happen. And I would like to say that I think there's been some kind of glossing over what may or may not be the economic impact benefit of that plant for this community, particularly the promised average wages. Average wage for a company like Pratt & Whitney doing manufacturing in our area doesn't really tell you a whole lot. It would be a lot more interesting, for example, to know what the median wage is, because the average wage could be wildly skewed by having some extremely high paid executives and then a whole bunch of folks on the other end earning much more modest wages. So I don't know what their wage structure looks like, and therefore it's hard to really say how much of that wage income will really benefit the people who are doing, the lion's share of the employees. I would much prefer that the city and the county invest in other segments of our economy rather than the military-industrial complex, for sure. And in fact, a long-term goal of mine is to see our city become a true center for climate resilience, ecologically sustainable energy production, technology, and education. I think we ought to be the country's go-to exemplar for climate-related and sustainable energy production and education and deployment. Why are we not recruiting solar panel production? Why are we not investing in alternative energy storage technologies? These are things that we have we basically have all the initial resources we need here. We have the universities, we have the technical schools, we have NOAA here, we have climate consultants and experts in abundance. We could be bringing the premier manufacturers of environmentally responsible technologies here, because we can and should be educating our students, our young folks in these technologies. Let's recruit those industries to Asheville and provide appropriate levels of tax abatement to them that are commensurate with the benefits that having Asheville being known as a center for environmental responsibility and innovation would bring. We should be the premier location for this kind of work. We have the natural environment that needs preservation. We have a city that desperately needs alternative sources of energy that aren't dependent on fossil fuels. And we have the population that cares about these things. So I would prefer to see us recruiting and providing incentives to those efforts rather than, in fact, really any kind of heavy industry that is ecologically damaging or, frankly, to military production, which we already have more than enough of, in my view.
County Commissioner Amanda Edwards called for a walkout of North Carolina teachers as part of a push for higher pay, as reported on the Asheville FM News Hour on August 24th. She said that she thought such a walkout would be a bold step. Would you support such a call, considering that national test results released on September 1st showed in stark terms the pandemic's devastating effects on American school children, with the performance of 9-year-olds in math and reading dropping to levels from 2 decades ago?
Well, my first observation about this is that I believe that proposals to improve education should come first from the people doing that work, and that is to say, from educators. I'm proud to have been endorsed by both the Buncombe County and the Asheville City Associations of Educators. And I believe that their ability to organize and to determine what actions are most appropriate and effective for them should be honored. So I don't think that as an elected official, it's appropriate for me to independently call for a strike on behalf of folks who are already organized and can make those decisions for themselves. I heard from a number of folks who were dismayed that Commissioner Edwards had spontaneously called for this without any prior consultation with the BCAE or the ACAE. You know, it's awkward to ask people to go on strike when my understanding is that it's not legal for them to do that and they could lose their jobs. I think it's incumbent upon all of us as citizens of North Carolina to put pressure on our representatives in Raleigh to better allocate state funds. We're spending billions and billions on all sorts of things like widening interstates and other projects while letting the pay of our teachers languish. And I think that's absolutely inexcusable. North Carolina used to have a reputation for fantastic public school system, and that has been deliberately eroded by a Republican majority in the General Assembly that seems to be interested in undermining public education so that people can profit from private education. And by people, I mean them. We're seeing that undermining happening in all sorts of very dangerous ways. People taking over school boards and banning books and making outrageous claims about perfidious behavior by teachers and administrators and so forth. It's really a pernicious development, and that's what we should be putting our attention on, making sure that our schools are properly funded. It's not like the tax dollars aren't available. We have a huge rainy day reserve fund. At the very least, I mean, we're talking like billions of dollars. There's no excuse for not raising the pay. We're losing teachers all the time to South Carolina and other states, which pay better and better support their teachers. That's where the emphasis should be. And unfortunately, that's not something that we have any control over locally. I wish it were, but our tax monies are appropriated by the General Assembly, and they are not properly supporting teacher pay. And that needs to change. And we'll do everything we can to support our local legislators in Raleigh. And I hope we'll have a terrific contingent going there after this election, including folks with experience in education. And I would like to see efforts to continue to lobby to make sure that this disgrace of underfunding teachers comes to an end.
The purpose of the city's municipal climate action plan is to bring together the city's 2009 sustainability management plan, updated resolutions, and newly adopted resolutions around climate resiliency and climate justice into a comprehensive plan via which the city can move forward with planning for action regarding climate change. Work on the plan began last September and was originally intended to be completed by the first week of April, but a draft version, first slated for February, is not yet available. And Council's planning calendar indicates that members won't vote to approve the document until at least late October, and there's been no availability of any interim documents to the public for comment. Do you believe that this work meets appropriate standards for transparency and accountability? And what do you hope that the plan, when completed, will include?
Well, this touches on one of my keystone concerns for my campaign, and that is about responsiveness, inclusiveness, transparency, and accountability in city government. It is unfortunate that the opaqueness of this process in such an important effort, a climate action plan, is not a solitary example. This happens all through our city government, and that needs to change. People need to be able to see the folks who are doing the public's work, doing it in public. We're paying for it. We elected the people who chose the consultants. We deserve to see work product as it's produced. And if it's not being produced in a timely fashion, we deserve to know why. It is impossible to hold government accountable if there's no transparency. And if you can't hold your government accountable, you don't have a democracy. So what we have here is a bunch of folks doing a bunch of work. Where are the deliverables? Where are the reports? Where are the public hearings? It's a black box. We don't know what's going on. And at some point, some of this, I hope, relatively soon, will come to the public. But by that time, the opportunity for folks to contribute their perspectives, to see how the work is being done and so forth, will have long passed. And then what will probably happen is there'll be a series of public hearings or maybe a survey or something like that as a nod to public engagement. And then, as usual, council will go behind closed doors and make a bunch of decisions. And then they'll come and sit on the dais and they'll do us the courtesy of an hour's worth of kabuki of public comment. And then they'll vote the way they intended to vote. I've seen this happen. I've been going to city council meetings for years now. I've seen this happen over and over, and it's truly frustrating. We really need a city government that responds to the needs and concerns of the people who live here, that actually includes us in the process early enough for it to make a difference, and that is transparent about how it does its business so that they can be held accountable. I'd like people to know that I've made a pledge to our city that if I'm elected, when it comes to business that's coming before council, every week I'm going to write a report, who I talked to, what we talked about, any documents that they shared with me. Every week I'm going to be out in the community talking to neighbors, talking to community associations, talking to public interest groups, advocacy groups, and getting their views on those matters as well. And I'm including that in the report and how all of this is affecting my thinking on the topic. So when it comes time to vote, you'll not only see how my thinking has evolved, but you'll also have had an opportunity to influence it. So there won't be any surprises when it comes time for me to vote. You may not always agree with the decision that I make, but at least you'll understand how I got there. This seems to me to be job one of a publicly elected official who's making decisions that affect people's lives on a daily basis. And it shocks me that that's not something that that council members do as a matter of course. Now, obviously, there are occasions where there are legal restrictions on what a person can convey. And of course, I'll abide by those. But for the vast majority of the business of council, I think it needs to be open and transparent. And because council gives direction to the city manager, and the city manager is responsible for the work of city staff, I want to ensure that council is directing the city manager to give the same instructions to city staff about being transparent about their work as well. A little bit of a digression. What would I like to see in the plan? I would like to see a plan that addresses neighborhood resilience, that addresses climate mitigation in an equitable way. I would like to see the urban forester who will hopefully come on board very shortly. I know that the person has already been hired. I'm not sure when they're actually starting. I don't have the details on that, but that seems to me to be a critical component of any climate action plan. I want the product here to be specific about what sorts of efforts will be taken to address climate mitigation with timelines and goalposts and measurables so that we can monitor the effectiveness of what happens. I would also like to see incentives to make it desirable for builders, for businesses, and for residents to take action to improve their own energy usage and move whenever possible to renewables.
On August 8th, Asheville FM reported that the city of Asheville and Buncombe County had filed a class action antitrust lawsuit against HCA Healthcare Incorporated, Mission Hospital, and related business entities seeking injunctive relief and damages resulting from alleged anti-competitive practices. HCA Healthcare, Novant Health, and Advent Health have applied to build 67 beds and have filed certificates of need with the Division of Health Services Regulation. Of these three entities, HCA, Novant, and Advent Health, which would you as a council member support and why?
Well, one of the reasons that I moved to Asheville as opposed to somewhere else 10 years ago was because we had what was at the time one of the most highly rated and excellent not-for-profit hospitals in the country. I was very unhappy when it was sold to a for-profit mega corporation. And I've been working closely, well, working isn't the right word. I've been supporting with great vigor the unionization efforts and then the union actions of the National Nurses Union now in Asheville in pushing back against the employment practices which are harming patient care, for example. So I would definitely not be interested in having the Mission Hospital expand its hold on our community. Between the other two, Novant and Advent Health, I can say that I have chosen under emergency circumstances in the last couple of years to go to Advent Health, which is 15 or 20 minutes away from me, rather than Mission, which is 10 minutes away from me. And I've got nothing but good things to say about the healthcare that I received at Advent Health. I don't know very much about Novant, except what I've read from people who've written in with their experiences, most of which seem to be quite positive. I also know it's another not-for-profit, as is Advent. I am, however, concerned about some of what I have come to understand about the policies of Advent Health, namely that they do not provide any elective abortion services at their facilities, and that they require that only sorts of abortions they do have to go through an ethics committee where it's either the health of the life of the mother, a fetal condition that's not compatible with survival, or a documented case of rape and incest, because as we all know, all of those cases are documented, right? Sorry, sarcasm 101. So it gives me pause to recommend in favor of Advent Health for those reasons. It's also, you know, it's an organization founded by and whose board of directors are Seventh-day Adventists, and they have religious convictions. Some of them are not what I would describe as hospitable towards LGBTQ. Sorry. Same-sex marriage, trans folks who are transgender. This concerns me. I have not heard anything about any of those things with respect to Novant. So kind of by default, I guess I would recommend Novant.
Recently, a 19-mile section of the French Broad River in Buncombe County was declared, in quotes, impaired by water quality officials. In 2020, 69% of sampled sites along the river failed to meet the EPA's E. coli standards for safe recreation. Would you feel comfortable recreating in the French Broad River? What interventions, if any, do you think the city should be making on behalf of the river's water quality?
Well, to answer the first part of that question, you won't catch me swimming in the French Broad anytime soon. I think floating down the river, I would take a good long shower afterwards and make sure I didn't have any open wounds if I was going to do that. It's distressing to hear about a reduction in the evaluation of the health and safety of the French Broad. It's no surprise. Most of that E. coli contamination is fecal matter. And that comes from three main sources: upstream farming, where runoff that's loaded up with either manure, fertilizer, or animal products ends up in streams and rivers, and that runs into the French Broad and accumulates there. Some of it comes from sewer leakage and from septic line tank leakage. And to the extent that the city is responsible for, or the Metropolitan Sewer District or other entities are responsible for maintaining sewer lines and ensuring that they are intact and safe and delivering wastewater for cleaning and removal of contamination, that is a city responsibility, and we should be paying close attention to that. It's worth noting that our sewer line and water line infrastructure in many neighborhoods is in very bad shape. In a 5-block radius around my home in Shiloh, for example, we've had, I would say, somewhere around the order of half a dozen water breaks that have had to be repaired in the last 5 or 6 months. Two of them literally on the intersection that my house is, and one that was just repaired very recently. We have a desperate need for refurbishment of our water infrastructure. And so that's something that the city, I've recently at the most recent city council meeting, there was a 10-year plan for this with, which is needed in order to apply for both ARPA and the bipartisan infrastructure bill funds. And I'm glad to see that the city is getting out in front of that so that we can get our share of the money to rebuild this vital infrastructure. So that's part one, infrastructure. Second part is mitigation of stormwater to begin with. And that has to do with zoning codes about creating permeable surfaces so that we don't have runoff that just goes directly into the river without having a chance of being treated and improved before it gets there. And also the importance of tree canopy. Trees are the ultimate water filtration system. They take up water, they clean it, they help mitigate stormwater as well, stormwater runoff. So we need to be prepared for increasing big rain events like the one that's bearing down upon us this afternoon from Hurricane Ian, where we get dumped a huge amount of water all at once, and that rushes through our storm drain facilities, taking with it every bit of loose matter, including, you know, whatever our animals leave at the curb for people who haven't picked them up, and rushes them down into the river. There are a bunch of organizations that are working on this. The Asheville Stormwater Task Force Coalition, Riverlinks Central Asheville Watershed Restoration Plan, and a lot of people are going to have to work in conjunction with each other to identify sources that are happening on private land, to mitigate things that are happening on public lands, and to make sure that we're, you know, this downgrade, the one good thing about it is that it makes us eligible for EPA funds that can help us address some of these concerns. And obviously the city needs to do its part in contributing to those efforts and working with these various coalitions. I'm uncomforted by the number of eyes that are on this problem, people with expertise in this area. And my hope is that working together in collaboration, we can turn this around as quickly as possible.
Asheville's tourism director, Vic Isley, said on August 31st that hotel bookings have been down for three straight months, May, June, and July. Just a few years ago, hotels were 100% booked during this time. She also says that the trend is expected to continue through the fall. This fall in bookings occurred in the face of a 2021-22 BCTDA board budget in which $15.3 million was designated for advertising and public relations expenditures, including $1.3 million paid for Asheville advertisements during the 2022 U.S. Open tournament in New York City. Given the decline in bookings, would you say that the TDA expenditures were a good use of public funds? And would you suggest continuing expenditures at that level during your tenure on the City Council?
Ah, yes, the TDA. It's worth noting that a few years ago, saying that hotels were 100% booked and saying that they're less fully booked now, it's important to note how many hundreds more hotel rooms have been added in that interval. So are bookings down in absolute numbers? No, they're not. So if you're talking about percent capacity, Asheville has been adding, one might say irresponsibly, to the number of hotel rooms. So our capacity has greatly grown. And so when we say our number of bookings are down as a percentage of capacity, that doesn't necessarily mean number of bookings, period, are down. In fact, it's the contrary. I attended the TDA meeting this past Wednesday on the 28th. And they show a decline in bookings, down 7% from 2019 and down 2% from 21 in hotels, and down, and but on conversely up 2% for Airbnb short-term rentals, up 2% from 2019 and down from 2021. So the numbers are variable across categories. There's no indication of any massive slowdown happening here. The TDO is fond of telling us that $2.6 billion in visitor spending comes into the county. What they don't tell us is how much of that $2.6 billion stays in the county. The reality is a huge proportion of it is siphoned out of our community. And meanwhile, the jobs that they tout, $950 million in workforce income, a great deal of that is in really, highly inadequate wages to folks who are working on unpredictable schedules and who can't afford to live in the city where they work. What we don't know about tourism in Asheville is what it costs. We have the numbers for how much comes in. We don't have numbers about how much stays here. And we don't know what it costs us to support that industry. We don't know what it costs us in infrastructure. We don't know what it costs us in so-called opportunity costs, which is to say what other businesses or industries or economic activity could we have that might serve us better than tourism. We are hamstrung once again by Raleigh in this matter. We have no control over the rate of the occupancy tax, nor how that occupancy tax gets allocated between TDA marketing and county and city spending on tourism-related infrastructure and a few other possible items. That money does not go into our general coffers to be spent as the citizens of Asheville deem best. We're told we have to go hat in hand and say, oh, shucks, we'd like to do this with the money. And then the TDA has to say, yes, that seems appropriate. It'll boost tourism, support tourism. In Colorado, they recently passed legislation that gives the power to counties and municipalities to determine how their occupancy tax monies are spent. We do not have that power. And even though the ratio of 67 to marketing and 33% to city and county tourism related infrastructure has improved, it's still a terrible arrangement in many ways. For example, the TDA tells us that, oh, if the occupancy tax went away, households would have to pay $2,261 a year more in taxes. Well, first of all, that number is bogus because they're already keeping 66% of that. And if it went away, that money would disappear. The remaining 33% would be approximately $750 for a household, which is still a lot of money. But at least it would be money that would be spent the way the people who live here would like it to be spent. There's an organization being pulled together by a guy named Ben Williamson called Buncombe Decides, who proposes that we might consider asking the county to just stop collecting the occupancy tax. It's kind of like defund the DDA idea. And then see if that might prompt a renegotiation about how occupancy tax monies are allocated and spent. And I think there's some merit to that approach because it's not something that's going to happen voluntarily by the TDA, which is a completely appointed entity. It has virtually no responsibility to the residents of this city or county, and these folks are unelected. We need a better system than what we've got. And the outrage about how the money is spent is just the tip of the iceberg. The fact that we have no control over taxes that are being raised by our county government and then allocated by this independent entity that is in service only to the tourism interests, business interests. It's a very flawed system, and we need to do whatever we can to improve it.
High density housing is a primary goal of the city, as detailed in Living Asheville, a Comprehensive Plan for Our Future, and adopted by the City Council. Neighborhood associations and local homeowners have spoken out against previous urban development plans and recent changes to the city's zoning laws in favor of maintaining city character, green space, and property values. Do you support high density housing development? And how would you respond to community members accompanying complaints?
Ooh, contentious. Here's the bottom line. Asheville is growing, and Asheville will continue to grow. That's just the bottom line reality of the situation. We can't build a moat around the city and pull up the drawbridges and stop people from coming here. That's just not going to happen. The question is, how are we going to grow? How are we going to grow in a livable, environmentally responsible, and in a way that maintains the things that we love about the city? Change is inevitable. The question is, what kind of change are we going to get? We have a unified development ordinance, which is the zoning, that is the product of years of what I call the coral reef school of development, which is to say, there was a UDO, and then there have been overlays and variances and patchwork changes in the UDO. I think we need to revisit our city zoning from the ground up with those goals of livability, of access to walkability and access to public transportation, and climate resilience in mind. I believe we do need many more opportunities for people to do human scale infill development. Sprawl is an economic, is an environmental catastrophe. It will truly degrade our quality of life. It will make us more car dependent, and it will damage our natural environment. We need to build characterfully and deliberately and carefully, more densely, closer in, where we have infrastructure to support more housing, and along transportation corridors that can be served by public transportation. This stuff is deeply contentious. Understandably, we have to do it with careful planning so that we don't lose the things that we love about Asheville. Its trees, its quirky character. But we can't just close our eyes and block our ears and go la 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 and hope that change won't happen. Change is going to happen. We need to do it in a conscientious fashion. I recently watched a really interesting TED talk by a gentleman named Vishan Chakrabarty. And he describes a form of housing development, which is environmentally responsible and sustainable. And the keystone of it is kind of the sweet spot is three-story multifamily dwellings in clusters that have walkable neighborhoods, which have neighborhood amenities like shopping store, grocery stores, and so forth, so that, and parks and recreation areas, so that people can live in these areas and get around easily and not have to have cars. And these buildings are, get this, carbon negative construction. They actually take carbon out of the system. I recommend that you have a look at this TED Talk. You can find it through a post on my website, tovish4avl.com/building-carbon-negative. Building carbon negative. It's fascinating, and I think represents a really hopeful model for the future. These buildings have sustainable, renewable technologies built into them, and they are built using techniques that are not carbon intensive. And the net effect, the effect is they actually sequester carbon throughout their life. This is something that I think Asheville can do and should do, and we should provide incentives for this kind of construction and development.
Nina Tovish, thank you for being on Asheville FM NewsHour today.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to speak at length about some of my views.